Hello, and thank you for taking a listen to this week's episode of Secure Insights with NDK Cyber. So, for those that don't know, NDK Cyber is a cybersecurity recruitment organization, first and foremost. That's our bread and butter. We've been doing this for 10 years plus now, and we specialize in introducing cyber talent to organizations all over the world. Those organizations range from end user right through to vendor and services organizations, with roles ranging from your entry level right through to leadership and all your weird and wonderful skill sets in between. Now, the NDK Secure Insights series is all about shining a light on certain areas that should be being talked about in cybersecurity, that are being talked about in cybersecurity, and really bringing experts to enable them to share their thoughts, their expertise, their experiences in whatever the topic may be. Now, this week, very excited to be joined by Phil Marasco. Phil is somebody who's been in the OT and the ICS security space for a long time now. That's his specialist area. And on today's episode here, we talk through everything from how to assess the OT vendors before bringing them into your environment. We talk through how to make better use of the management console to form better cybersecurity practices. And also we talk through three top challenges around assessing risk when it comes to OT security environments. So I think there's a hell of a lot of value here. Very excited to share and look forward to the feedback.
Well, Phil, thank you so much for jumping on today. I know you're a busy guy. So all the listeners would have had a brief introduction from myself there. But in your own words, you want to give us a brief overview of your background for a bit of context?
Pleasure to be on the podcast. Thanks for having me. My name is Phil Marasco. I've been a security professional since 2003. I started in operations with a large ISP, and then I moved to a managed security services firm working in their security operations center for about 5 years. From there, I went to consulting. I've been an OT security professional since 2008, working for power companies, oil companies, and critical infrastructure protection. So part of that work, I see a lot of everything from vendor devices all the way to security assessments and risk assessments, as well as some compliance things with NERC-SIP and other federal regulatory agencies. So I see the whole gamut.
Nice. And so you've been in this world since 2008 then. So before the OT security terminology was being banded around like it is now, I guess.
Yeah, to a large extent. I mean, utilities and other places that use OT, they had security, but for more of a availability and resiliency than straight out attack. They were worried about that, of course, but they needed to know the systems that they were working with would be always available and always up, and you know, keep the lights on or keep the refinery running or keep the pipeline going. So they did have elements of that, but it became a lot more progressive after some of the issues we've seen in the last few years. So we are definitely more of an attack vector now than we used to be.
Yeah, understood. So I've got some questions here that I was going to bounce off you. So if we could jump right in, I guess, if you had five questions that anybody could ask an OT vendor before buying, where would you go?
Excellent. All right. So I work with a lot of OT vendors. We do a lot of risks and vulnerability assessments. Clients spend a lot of money securing OT devices. They're not made for the internet. They're not made to be in the cloud. They're meant to be off by themselves, working, you know, diligently doing what they do. A lot of them weren't even meant to be networked. I mean, some of them are still use serial load that are being wrapped in a TCP wrapper so they can still work in a network. So those systems really were never meant to be where they are today, but they still work and they still do the job that they were designed to do. And so companies still use them. And so there's a lot of cost in making those systems safe, secure, and reliable. And so when new systems come online, a lot of people have realized that they'd rather have a secure system going in because it relieves them of a lot of duties that they have to do now. They know that the vendor is better off at putting security in the device than they are, you know, layering security around it. Bolting it on is never as good as baking it in, as we say. There are some protocols that some of these systems use. We even have to use special gateways. OPC is one of them, object linking and embedding for process control. That needs a special gateway just to work through a firewall. So a lot of these protocols are so specific and unique to the environment that making them work in other ways than they were designed is almost impossible. So it's better to have it from the very beginning than try to make it fit and be secure after the fact. So the first question I ask, and these are all meant for anyone that they can ask without having a security professional on the call. Okay. And I also make them be multiple purpose. So the first one is, you know, can your CISO join the call? Now, getting somewhat the C-level with a security background on a call may not happen, but it does send a message to sales about how important cyber is to you. You also have the side benefit of finding out if they actually have one. A lot of smaller OT companies, they are more about speed to market agility than making sure that they have a mature process. And so cybersecurity is something that should be at the C-level, that needs budget, it needs oversight, and it needs governance. And if a company doesn't have that, then the product likely won't have it either. So if you ask a CISO, if you ask for a CISO from the salesperson, in my experience, the CISO will find out about it if there is one. I've talked to three CISOs in the last 3 years. Unfortunately, every time it was in an effort to save the sale, not to cement it. So CISO is the top level for security in an environment. And so they have a pulse on what everything is going on in the company. Security-wise, they probably also have all of the security SMEs in their direct chain of command. So they're probably the best person to get on a sales call if you can get them. Unlikely. It does usually, if it gives a salesperson pause, you sort of want to figure out what that pause is. You also should be fine with if they give you a sales engineer that does security, they should be able to answer those questions anyway. It is sort of a opening shot to show that security is part of your requirements, and it's not supposed to be just something that they add on or tack on later as something that's a freebie or merely overhead. You want sales to understand that security, cybersecurity is part of what you're looking for in a product and not just the features that they give you. The other thing to consider is that you hopefully can get someone better at security than you are on the call. You can't fix problems inside of an application. You can't fix problems inside of the architecture that the product's been designed around. Only the vendor can really do that. So making sure that they are better at security with their product than you are is the first step in making sure that it's a viable product to purchase in the first place.
Understood. Getting that CISO on the call. What if there's
If you can. Now, obviously CISOs don't join all the calls. They probably don't join any, but they're going to find out about it. And then, hopefully they'll assign you somebody that can answer those questions. If they can't, that'll be very telling. And the rest of that call would probably not go as quite as you'd hoped.
Yeah, that's fair. What about someone in, say, like a vendor environment? I don't know, XYZ OT security vendor solves this problem for you. Yeah, we've got a CISO. They're more of an internal CISO though, so they look after our systems internally. They're not sort of an SME from a technical standpoint on the product. Would maybe, I don't know, like a more of like a CTO or a chief product officer, but technical. Would they sort of carry
Getting
the same sort of weight?
anybody with security on a sales call is key.
Got it. Got it.
Just that they have them available and they're part of the sales chain. If sales, if security isn't part of sales, then is security going to be part of the product? And we usually find that those two go hand in hand. And some of the other questions will help a bit more to figure out where it fits in that. But we always say security starts at the top, and it should be at the top of the capabilities and what you ask during a sales call. Maybe not the first question. You want to make sure it does what you think it should do, but security should be something that should be top of mind for anybody who wants to buy something that they're going to put an OT environment.
Understood. Got it. Cool. So get the security person on the call or request for the security person on the
Yeah.
call.
You can
What
shoot
else
it as
do
high as you want and then see what they give you, but somebody
Let's
should be
see
there.
what they give you. Fair enough. Okay, cool. And so what else are we looking at asking on these?
The next one is also a more of a corporate level question. I usually just ask, when was your last SAS 70 or SOC 2 compliance audit completed? That is a corporate standard, not specifically a security standard, but all corporate security standards that are of any note include cybersecurity elements. And, if a lot of corporations also have a vendor risk assessment to make sure that any vendors they purchase from are going to be reliable. If you don't have a SAS 70 or SOC 2, you're likely to fail that vendor risk assessment. And so that's one of the bare minimums it takes for a lot of our larger clients to even do business with you if you're a vendor, an OT vendor. So it shouldn't be something that they should be surprised by. The people that have the most problem with this are going to be new vendors, small vendors that haven't gone that far in their corporate life. And they don't have enough bureaucracy, maybe it would be one word, or maturity would be another one, to make sure that they have those corporate standards in place alongside of everything else that they're doing. It is an additional barrier to entry. It does, mean that you have to have some level of due diligence, but those things are good to have when you're doing an OT product. You don't want to get a product that is out there just because of its capability and not because of its other aspects like stability and reliability and, security. So the other side benefit of having a company that has a SAS 70 or some other standard, they already know that security is required. They already have an idea of how to work through those security standards and those processes. And so they understand the governance issues and the budgetary ones around maintaining those standards. And so adding those into the product isn't as big a leap as it is for a company that hasn't done that process. So they're a lot more better equipped to meet the standards for their product since they have to do that for their corporate environment as well.
Yeah, got it. So they're already clued up on those points there. That makes sense. Okay, cool. Nice. And so what else are we asking? What else are we looking at from these vendors?
Next one is actually, this one usually catches people off guard. It's what kind of vulnerability scanner do you use in QA?
Okay.
Now, this one, their answer here gives you multiple things. One, do they have a QA process? A lot of OT vendors may not. And we rely on quality assurance to make sure that we get a specific product working the way we expect, the way that the vendor expects it to perform in real life. It also is the one time that a vendor can actually look at a product before it goes out to make sure that it, will meet whatever standards that they said the original product met. So if it has a QA process, the second thing is security part of that process? And security needs to be part of QA to make sure that any vulnerabilities that may have been eradicated during the development haven't propped come back up during a patching process, that someone hasn't changed something in the product as part of test that opens up a new hole or adds a new service that's not supposed to be there, or maybe hardening didn't work, and so they have additional things that are configured the way they're not supposed to be. So it's their last gasp to make sure that before it goes out to the public that it meets the standards that it's supposed to meet. And finally, we also want to know what kind of scanner they use. Vulnerability scanners on OT systems are a very tricky thing. We would like vendors to use vulnerability scanners before the application gets out because we're going to use them when they hit the field. And a lot of OT systems rely on protocols that aren't so safe with vulnerability scanners. If you have a serial over a TCP connection and you run a vulnerability scanner on it, it's not going to open and close the connection the way that application expects, and it'll leave it in a hung state. If you're using it on systems that can't handle multiple connections or hundreds of connections, like a vulnerability scanner does, that actually emulates what happens in a regular network environment to some extent. And so we find that OT systems that can't pass a vulnerability scan usually are too brittle to put in operations anyway. We have to take a lot more care with systems that aren't vulnerability scanner safe, and we have to make sure that they don't sit on regular networks where they may be touched by systems that they shouldn't be. They shouldn't be anyway because they're OT, but we know how these systems work, and sometimes they get put in environments that we can't fully control anyway. I like knowing what vulnerability scanner they use just so that we can see what kind of due diligence that they go through. If they use something that's pretty standard, like a Nessus or a Rapid7, that's different than some other specialty scanners that we use. And that also gives an idea of their capabilities. Plus, we should never get a product from a vendor and we run a vulnerability scanner on it and we get a medium level alert or higher. That usually means one of three things. One, the system needs to be patched and we're not at the right patch level. Two, the vendor did something wrong and something that they didn't fix before it went to QA. Anything medium or higher in the federal, at least on the US federal side, would get flagged and have to be fixed right away. And then third, maybe we've configured it wrong. Maybe we enable a service that we shouldn't. Maybe we didn't do the hardening right. Maybe we put an empty password in. All those things can happen. But scanning OT systems before I go out into the field sort of ensures, it's also our last best chance to make sure that device goes out there in a safe and reliable manner. So those are all good things to know. And I hope everybody scans their systems before they put them out in the field because someone may scan them accidentally. And you don't want, the first time that an OT and system sees a vulnerability scan to be in your environment or in production. It's a bad day for everybody.
No, of course. Yeah, no, hopefully that's a sort of standard best practice, but you never know in today's day and age. Okay, cool. So, and then the fourth question we're looking to ask these vendors.
How do we contact it if there's a security patch to apply? Again, this is a sort of a multifaceted question. One, we expect that there is a security patching process. You'd be surprised how many OT devices we get out. And we find out that the patching process doesn't exist, that patching is really just reinstalling. And that's assuming that they'll actually take the patch and they'll recognize it as their vulnerability and do something with it. And then the other half of that is, hey, we expect to get contacted when there is a patch. Now, how will we know that something is wrong or potentially wrong and needs to be remediated or corrected with the application or the system that we're doing? So that assumes that there's a notification chain, they have some email list, they have some working group that information gets distributed through. And so that means that there is some maturity around that notification process. This also assumes that there are several functions inside the vendor, that there's a process check for vulnerabilities. that they actually, that's hopefully QA isn't the first time they run a scan, but it might be. But there's a remediation mitigation process to evaluate and respond to anything that they find. That there's dev QA or cyber cycles budgeted to work through that process, because once you find something needs to be patched, you actually have to do something to fix it. And that usually requires going back to development or going back to testing and then doing some iteration until that issue's been resolved. That requires governance to make sure that whole process goes accordingly. Someone's got to know that, hey, there is an issue. We have to go back and do additional cycles on testing and patching and figure out how to fix the issue. And then, of course, finally, there's the communication channels to let their client base know that something needs to be updated on the system. If a vendor doesn't have all of those things, then it's going to be very hard to remediate issues, and you don't want a 0 day that you can't patch. That's bad for everybody as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Okay, cool. And the fifth and final thing that you would suggest.
All right, this one. A lot of people, when we talk about this question, they're surprised that it's even a question. But unfortunately, found out we have to ask. Are security
Okay.
patches included with support, and how long can we expect them to come out after disclosure? A lot of OT vendors, well, not a lot. There are several specific OT vendors that do not include security patches with their product. It's an additional fee. It could be
Wow.
several million dollars. This was one vendor managed to charge multiple millions of dollars for an OT system patch and made and charge it to all of their clients. So they each one thought they were paying for their specific patch, and they actually ended up paying for the patching process over and over and over again. So that actually became quite well known and quite discussed in less than pleasant terms. We expect that security patches are included as part of support, and we now know that's not a safe assumption, especially in OT. And if you have to pay extra for security, what are you actually buying? If there's a safe version and an unsafe version, I guess if you don't buy security, then you get the unsafe version. The answer to this question isn't really cut and dried. We don't expect to see hard timelines like 30 days, 60 days, or 2 weeks to get a patch out, because each issue is different. It may take longer to fix, but we would expect that there is a communication commitment. That will tell you within like 48 hours of disclosure, and then we'll give you a mitigation option within another 24 hours after that, and then we'll give you updates every 7, 14 days until we get a patch out. Now, those are the those numbers can change, but those are the basic parts. Telling you that's going on, telling you if there's any mitigation you can do in the meantime, and then give you updates about when you can patch. And oh yeah, by the way, that patch also has to scale, right? If you have 10,000 of these devices and have to go out and send a person out to each device and do a reinstall, that's not an easy process. And hopefully their patching process takes into account how to scale that and potentially even centralize it. So that also depends on your management tools. So which we'll get into in just a second. But patching should be a regular part of the process for any device. We go through Patch Tuesday from Microsoft Windows every month. We understand that even when we patch a system, we can't assume that it's error free until the next month. So patching should be something that every OT vendor is able to supply, and every buyer knows that they're going to have to do. And so that's one thing we also work with clients to make sure that they understand that once these systems are out in the field, that there is going to be some maintenance and upkeep for them. And so when they buy a new system, they have to figure out how that maintenance and upkeep will fit in their workflow and be able to work with the whatever the size of the install base they have.
Yeah, no, I would have thought that would be a sort of even when us as a recruitment company, if we're buying software and systems, we understand that it's not going to be the finished article forever. There'll be patching and maybe changes and software updates and all that good stuff. But yeah, I wasn't aware of the charging additional fees to patch the software. I don't know whether I'm speaking out of term here, but it seems a bit unethical, maybe. I don't know. But
Unethical is one way to put it. Some of the practice behind that specific situation really swore a lot of people off of that vendor. Unfortunately, they have a very, very large stranglehold on some of the segments that they work in, and so they can get away with it. I think that's changing now. If they can get away with it, they will try. They've proven time and again that it's not outside the realm of possibility.
wow. Well, that's a learn for myself today. So the five questions we're looking at asking any OT vendor then before we're buying, we're getting the security person involved, preferably CISO, that sort of level.
As high as you can get,
Yeah.
it's easy to ask, as long as they provide somebody. Now, you don't need to get the CISO, of course, but as long as they can answer your questions. And the CISO's, where that buck stops, quite literally. That's they're at the C level and that's their responsibility. So getting them or their designate on the call will ensure that you get the answers that they have available. They may not be the ones you want, but at least you have somebody give you an answer.
Yeah, exactly. So we're doing that. We're ensuring they have patching processes
Yes.
available.
Assume any software written by people, even though AI is technically not people. Assume that you're gonna have to patch it eventually.
Understood. Asking around the vulnerability scanning.
Exactly. They need to have a security practice just like you have a security practice. And we use vulnerability scanning to validate anything that we buy, and they should do the same with anything that they sell.
Yeah, understood. Cool. That's fine. So that's the first three. Remind me of the other two, sorry.
Make sure that they have some sort of corporate standard that they adhere to,
That was the one of
like a
them.
SAS 70 or a SOC 2. And then how do we get contacts if there's an issue?
Cool. So these are all actionable things you can take away as I'm looking at X vendor. What do I need to be looking at from a very high level? And then you can obviously customize that as to the specifics on what you're looking at there. And so from an OT management console perspective, what could you do? What could your OT management console do to support your cybersecurity efforts?
There's actually a lot it can do. The best cybersecurity tool is an operational tool, and vice versa. A lot of OT management consoles do give you a lot of information that you can use on for cybersecurity reasons as well as operational reasons. If we buy just a cybersecurity tool, it's very hard to get that kind of sale through a lot of companies. And so we often have to reuse what we already have. And so a lot of the management consoles that are out there will actually give you a lot of cybersecurity information. First thing is just monitoring, knowing when your systems are up. A lot of OT operators, we don't have fancy dashboards. We don't know, metrics that we have in a data center about how long a transaction taking or how fast some of the systems are operating or whatever fancy things that we can get bells and whistles for a regular IT device. In OT, we don't have that benefit or luxury. There's really, the systems don't lend themselves to that. But the management console usually can tell you what's up, what stuff is working, that things are communicating like they're supposed to be. And so getting an idea of what's normal. And that is the biggest thing in cybersecurity is knowing what your normal is. Try to make sure that you can detect when it's no longer normal, and there's a problem. That doesn't mean it's a cybersecurity problem, but an outage, loss of systems, visibility issues, those are also things that could be security issues. So being able to determine when you're not normal, then you start looking at root causes, and hopefully, at the bottom of that list, cybersecurity issues as a potential root cause. 99.99% of the time, it's going to be issues with network, issues with application, issues, with people doing, stupid but authorized things. So a monitor is your best way to figure out, when is something not right. So it's one tool you have, and it's one tool that's at least gives you some idea what the pulse of the environment is, without doing a lot of heavy lifting. The second thing that you get is asset management. Knowing how systems are currently configured, what versions of software or firmware or whatever, application is out there can make all the difference. If there's a vulnerable system at 3 a.m. and you have to figure out, where is it? I have 50 of these things, and are any of them vulnerable and are any of them old? They're not always on the same version of software. They're not always in the same version of firmware, and not all vulnerabilities attack each of them equally. So, being able to use the asset management structure inside the management system will give you some idea of how bad something could be if something is raging inside the network. We use asset management tools a lot, and it's hard on some OT systems to understand exactly the breadth of the systems because as you it may take you years to put all these systems out, and so they're probably not all in the same version. So getting some idea of what's out there and what's vulnerable can be very important in a very short amount of time when stuff gets very dicey.
Understood. Okay, cool. Nice. And so just on that, where's the benefit of having the asset management sort of like the fire is at this particular system. That's what we need to go first. Is that the benefit?
Or the issue that we're talking about affects, anything on version 4 or above. Well, we have 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. So I need to know where all those systems are. Which is this like only a couple of systems that were being impacted because of their own, we only have a couple on that vulnerable version. Is it all of them? And so using the asset management piece built into a lot of these management consoles will give you an idea of exactly how far and widespread the problem is.
Yeah, got it. Okay, cool. Nice. So asset management, we've got monitoring. Where else would we be looking to go?
The next is patch management. Hopefully your management system has patch management built in. And so when you find out you're on a vulnerable version, the next step is obviously to patch them. And if your management console does that for you, then it becomes a lot easier process. I had a system just a couple of weeks ago. Actually, there was no patch management in the environment, and I had to go out and send, one gig of data over slow links to OT devices for 50 different machines. It takes a lot of time and a lot of effort, but if it's built into the management console, you can use that to ensure that all of your systems are up to the current patch level at least, and then also validate that the patches that you thought were pushed out actually were, so that you can have some sort of confidence in what your vulnerability actually is, or what your risk exposure is to that vulnerable version. And plus, automating that process or pushing out 50 at once is a lot better than you logging into each device and updating it manually.
Yeah, understood. Okay, cool. So that's a patch management features its head again on the. There's a theme here, isn't
Patch frequently.
there?
Patch
Yeah, I was
early
going
and
to say,
often.
once a year is probably not enough.
Yes. And then the last is remote log access. Once you know something is going on, you want to see what's going on the device, usually you can get those logs pulled remotely and centralized, so you can start working through either giving it to some system to automate and go look for the issue that you're searching for. But you can also get information of who's logged in, what they did, if you can start figuring out some triage, getting those logs from those systems, especially on OT devices where we don't have a lot of good logging anyway. Getting the status of the system is can be even more important than the monitoring feature. One reason is because if you have a very good attacker, they may be able to fuzz the monitoring information that the console is seeing. We have seen attacks like that, but the logs usually are something that you can use to validate what's going on in the environment. And since they're distributed, it's a lot harder for an attacker to go after all of them. So usually the remote log access helps us with, figuring out the order of operations when something bad happened, figuring out who's logged in and doing something if it's something that was required interactive login, or when, systems started to interact like they weren't supposed to. The logs in the system are actually one of the best ways for us to figure out not only recreate what's going on, but figuring out when systems have been remediated. We have pushed patches in the past, only to have them reinfected because the patch didn't work. And the only reason we knew that is because we used logs to figure that out, because we saw the behavior start beginning again and we couldn't pin it down. Like, the system's patched, why is it doing this? We go and look at the logs, and whatever was going on before is going on again. So we can work with the vendor and figure out how to fix that issue and move forward. And even though these systems are specifically maintained just for operations and managing the devices out there, these things do the same thing we need for security. Is it up? Is it working? What's out there? Where is it? How is it configured? Can I remediate it from here? And then, how do I validate that everything's back the way it's supposed to be using logs? So they all are very good security features, even though it's for a management tool.
Okay, cool. So we're looking at here then the monitoring piece, the asset management, the patch management, and then the remote log access. And so from your experience, is that something that companies maybe aren't doing as much, or they could do more for these in
Well,
these
one
areas?
thing that is the issue we find a lot is that they don't understand how to operate in a security mode when it calls for, when it's called for. We do tabletops with a lot of people. We work through these issues, and during a tabletop exercise, we're like, "All right, so this has happened. What will you do?" And we start working through the process. And then, we always get to the impasse of like, "Well, how will I know that, X, Y, or Z is happening?" And like, "Well, how would you know if the system is no longer functioning the way it's supposed to be?" And then they think for a while, and then, we'll prompt them like, "Well, don't you have a management system that tells you when your systems are up?" "Oh yeah, I can look there." And so we start working through those processes with them to let them understand that you don't have to have a lot of heavy duty security people. You just need to train the security features into your existing field folks. I think, my job in security is done is when everyone realizes security is part of theirs. And so building that into their work processes, security issues aren't the first thing or the first reason why something goes down, but it should be on the list. And if it's on the list, then your people should be able to know what to do when that looks like it's the potential issue. And so using their own tools to do that is the best way to make sure that they actually are successful doing it. Like I said, the best security tools and operations tool that they know how to use, because it's something that's they have no issues picking up and using. They understand its limitations, but they can also get use it to fix the issue that they're being faced with, even if it's a security issue.
Yeah, got you. Okay, cool. And this next question, we've touched on a few points in this already, so there may be some overlap, but the challenges in assessing OT risk, I know there's a lot out there, so to speak, and especially in the environment we're in now.
These are those things that you don't want to fall into, right? And so
Yeah.
these are the ones we head up against a lot. So they're not just for vendors, but they're for everybody. The first one is I call it Schrödinger's cyber risk box. Everyone knows that what Schrödinger's cat is, this idea that you have a cat in a box and it can be alive or dead or every potential permutation between until you open the box. Well, replace that cat with risk, and it has every potential of no risk to all the risk until you actually look, open the box and take a peek inside. And so we often run into people that believe in the Schrödinger's situation in that, I've not opened the box, I've not looked at the risk, but since we're still up and running, we must have no risk, and therefore we can move on. Risk is solved. As long as I don't open that box, everything's okay. And that situation works until it doesn't, until they actually have an issue, and then they realize how the magnitude of, what they've done by not looking at the risk situation. So making sure that people understand they actually need to look at risk is important. And not looking at it isn't a get out of, I won't call it jail, but getting out of the issue free card, because it's going to come up eventually, and usually when you don't want it to. So that's number one. Number two, we are a target. Why would anyone access to all of our insignificant devices with their insignificant connections to our insignificant data protected by our insignificant security budget? We're just small. There's no reason to come after us. Ransomware is no big deal. Just don't click on anything. And if you do, just restore from backup.
Okay.
Unless they got to the backups too. No one knows who we are, and a little publicity would be a good thing. So, it isn't that you have to be a target, it's that you're collateral damage on a lot of these situations. And so whether someone clicks on something, whether it was aimed at you or not, you're still compromised. Whether the system or the whatever the drive-by was, it wasn't meant for you, you were just a collateral damage in that situation, you're still compromised. And so even if you're not a target, you should act like you are. So getting people in that headspace is kind of important. And if you've ever been targeted, you operate like that from now on. You assume that you've been compromised and work like that. So it's unfortunate that some people go through that process a long time without having any incidents, and so they think that they're okay and that they're in the clear. So
Yeah,
that makes it
it's a
right.
conversation I think a lot of people are having at the moment, especially around whether you want to include nation states in this, and that's a whole sort of rabbit hole on its own. But I think what it seems to be the case of like the supply chain risk, for example, you are in a supply chain at somewhere, and like you say, even if you weren't the intended target, but you were just sort of caught in the crossfire to a degree. From what I gather, speaking to guys just like yourself, it's a case of let's assume we are the target unless told otherwise, and that's the best way.
Absolutely. The last one is it's only temporary. We're just testing this thing. We're putting it out. We don't need to know how everything works. So we're just going to, take a few shortcuts and take the least cost implementation to see if it's even possible. I can't tell you how many temporary installs become permanent, but they're all the time. I refer to it as P cubed. Proof of concepts become pilots. Pilots become production. And very often the beginning POC is the same as production. And making sure that people understand when they put things out there just for tests that it is just a test, that they do know what the difference between a proof of concept is for a pilot. And for those that don't know, a proof of concept is just making sure that the functional thing you're trying to do exists and works. A pilot actually is putting one of those systems out in a production environment with all of the production accoutrements like security, provisioning, QA, hardening, all of the things that would go into the production environment to make sure all of those functional pieces work. And then production is just scaling that pilot up using your production processes. So if you put something in just to make sure it's functional without the security bits around it, without all of the bells and whistles of how you do a proper deployment, and that becomes your production, then you're going to look at some problems. So just temporary, it's only temporary. It gets so many people into so much trouble all the time. And part of that is just because they don't want to touch it once it's working. They don't want to change it because they think they know how it works, and they don't want to add everything around it that goes with it because, you know, they made it this far, it should still be okay, right?
Wow. Okay, cool. So looking at here then, challenges in assessing OT risks, we're looking at open the risk box, see what's inside. Love the way you put that. Assuming you're a target, and then the avoiding the P cube situation there around, you know, don't just leave it. Make sure we're sort of continuously assessing it. Does it work? Is it secure? Is that what we're getting at there on that last point?
Yes,
Yeah.
absolutely.
Awesome. That's awesome. I think there's a lot of, in my eyes, sort of quick fire value in these, and it's one of those where you can sort of take that general model and apply it to your particular scenario and customize and tweak where needed. So yeah, I think there's a lot of value in there. Thank you for sharing. If people wanted to get in touch, how can they reach out?
You can reach me at SecureCon. We have a website. My email address is tmarasco@securecon.com. I'm also Googleable, so
Yeah. You're on LinkedIn as
whatever.
well.
Oh, I definitely am
That's all
also on
good.
LinkedIn.
Yeah, it's all good. It's all good. But no, I appreciate you sharing all that today, Phil. I really do. I know you're a busy guy, so I'll leave you to crack on, and we'll speak again soon.
All right, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Cheers, Phil.